From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And there is a lot of politics in the news today, to say the least. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's former senior advisor, Michael McKinley, is the latest administration insider to testify behind closed doors in the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry. And Democrats running for president made Elizabeth Warren their primary target last night in their fourth debate.
On Twitter this morning, President Trump called the Democratic candidates clowns and then said they can't get elected. We want to take a deeper look at the CNN New York Times debate with NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
And as Tanya said, Warren was the focus. But I want to jump to Joe Biden. He was asked, as expected, about that false narrative repeated by President Trump and others that Biden had a prosecutor fired in Ukraine to protect his son. Not true. But this week, Hunter Biden did say it was a mistake for him to be on a board in Ukraine because of the optics. Here's Joe Biden responding to a question about all of that.
My son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. I carried out the policy of the United States government in rooting out corruption in Ukraine. And if that's what we should be focusing on.
And he went on to talk about his son's statement speaking for itself and his son's statement speaking for itself again. And as you know, Domenico, Democrats are watching these debates with an eye on a possible future debate with candidate Trump. Do you think Biden's response might have convinced them that he can handle that?
I don't know. I was surprised at how quickly the debate moved on from the Hunter Biden business ties situation. And I understand that this is a conspiracy theory that Trump has peddled on the one hand. On the other hand, there is the ethics question mm-hmm. of whether Hunter Biden mm-hmm. should have even been serving in the first place on a board of a gas company when his father was vice president and handling that country's foreign policy as the point man for the United States. Now, all the other stuff Rudy Giuliani and President Trump talk about is really not true at all, and that's been fact-checked a bunch of times. But it was surprising to me that none of the candidates even wanted to answer or talk about or bring up any of whether or not the conflicts of interest, those ethics, are something that they would endorse. They have to figure out, Democrats have to figure out what kind of bar they want to set for ethics post-Trump.
Mm. Yeah. Domenico, I want to ask you about Elizabeth Warren. As you heard earlier, I was saying that she was their primary target, the other Democratic candidates. And one big issue that kept coming up again and again is that Warren wouldn't say whether middle class taxes would go up under Medicare for all. And Pete Buttigieg caught her on it. Here he is.
Let me be clear on this. Costs will go up for the wealthy. They will go up for big corporations and for middle class families. They will go down. I will not sign a bill into law that does not lower costs for middle class families.
Mayor Buttigieg, you say Senator Warren has been, quote, evasive about how she's going to pay for Medicare for all. What's your response?
Well, we heard it tonight. A yes or no question that didn't get a yes or no answer.
And lots of the candidates kept hammering her or going back to her on that. Domenico, what do you think? How did this moment resonate?
Well, look, last week was the first time that Elizabeth Warren caught Joe Biden in the average of the national polls. And congratulations, what happens when you wind up, you know, at the top in the polls, you become a front runner and you get a lot of that scrutiny. And for Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, we should remember, they really pinned in Elizabeth Warren on what is her biggest vulnerability, and that is whether she's electable. That's been the number one issue with Democrats in this primary.
But a lot of folks were just saying she also did not answer that question. Your thoughts about
that? Yeah,
she
didn't answer the question, but that's the point, is that she didn't answer the question. And the problem that what Pete Buttigieg in particular was pointing to is that her policies are too liberal to be elected, and she doesn't want to cop to the fact that people would have to probably see their taxes go up, because Bernie Sanders did say that that's what would happen. You know, Amy Klobuchar, on the other hand, was saying she's too dismissive of other people's ideas. And that's interesting thing. And we're going to see how Warren responds to all that.
That's right. And she actually spoke about Warren's wealth tax. Let's listen.
I want to give a reality check here to Elizabeth, because no one on this stage wants to protect billionaires. Not even the billionaire wants to protect billionaires. We just have different approaches. Your idea is not the only idea.
So, Domenico, we're hearing there Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, everybody just kind of puppy piling on. But how do you think Elizabeth Warren held up?
You know, she's going to have to be at the center now. I mean, she did not answer that question about whether people's taxes are going to go up. She also didn't really respond to Pete Buttigieg when he said that you don't have a plan on this. You have a plan on everything else, but has basically been using Bernie Sanders as a heat shield to sort of keep the pressure off of her when it comes to Medicare for All. And there's a reason why Pete Buttigieg kept bringing up Medicare for All Who Want It, as he calls it, which is essentially Medicare for All Who Want It, Medicare for All as a choice instead of as a replacement to private health insurance. When we polled on this in our NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll back in July, when you offer Medicare for All as a choice, 70% of Americans are for it. Mm-hmm. When you offer it as a replacement to private health insurance, only 41% of the country is in favor of that.
That's interesting. They have to navigate that. Well, so what else jumped out at you, Domenico?
Well, I mean, there were just so many things in this debate that were, a kind of a new dynamic. I don't think it reshaped the race in any sort of way. You still have a clear top tier. But Pete Buttigieg, I know I mentioned him a couple times already, was able to sort of, we keep asking who could jump out from the bottom tier, from the people who haven't been kind of, polling double digits. He's been creeping up in some state polls and really tried to say that there's a third choice. And he said that there's this false choice between Joe Biden saying that Trump is an aberration, which he disagrees with and says he's a symptom of something broader in the country, or Elizabeth Warren, where he said she wants, quote unquote, permanent partisan combat. So a unity message, but saying he sees something different than Biden does for the future.
I want to listen to Andrew Yang, who some people are giving, solid report cards for his performance last night. Here he is talking about what's killed manufacturing jobs.
Senator Warren, I've been talking to Americans around the country about automation, and they're smart. They see what's happening around them. Their Main Street stores are closing. They see a self-serve kiosk in every McDonald's, every grocery store, every CVS. Driving a truck is the most common job in 29 states, including this one. 3.5 million truck drivers in this country, and my friends in California are piloting self-driving trucks.
And a lot of us were noting he also had a pin that said math, which is all going on social media.
Make America think harder.
Oh, is there
what
you
that
go.
Yes. For.
Well, and also math. I mean, it's nice to have somebody, bragging about math.
I think he wanted to talk about math and just came up with an acronym.
But he's below tier, right? Mid tier or something. But who kind of shown that maybe, maybe we'll be being a bigger part of the Democratic Party, if not the candidate.
Look, Andrew Yang has had a loyal social media following. He raised double the amount of money in the third quarter than he'd raised the entire first couple of quarters, $10 million. So he has a lot of people who are behind him in a certain niche. And he certainly brings up an issue that a lot of Democrats in particular talk about, which is automation, how jobs have changed, how jobs will be changing. Unfortunately for Andrew Yang, his idea of a guaranteed universal basic income, which would essentially give Americans $1,000 per month, all American adults, to sort of ward off automation problems. Only 26% of the country is in favor of that, thinks it's a good idea based on our poll. So it's not an issue that goes to a broader public. Americans have this sense of wanting people to work for something. And that is one of those things that a lot of Democrats don't want to get sidetracked when their whole goal is to try to beat President Trump. Mm.
Domenico, one topic that we only heard about once during the debate is Sanders on his recent heart attack. Let's play that.
We're moving on, Senator.
I'm healthy.
Sorry.
I'm feeling great, but I would like to respond to that question.
He also won. He said he's feeling fine. He also won the endorsement of New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's really hard to say, but I'm wondering, the thoughts of the voters out there on his heart attack and if that will play a role in their thinking of him as a viable candidate in the future.
It brought up the issue of age, and a lot of people have been sort of seeing that as a taboo topic, but it really was thrust forward. They were asked specifically about age last night because the leading candidates in this race, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders are all septuagenarians. They're all 70 or older. And, Bernie Sanders has had strong health for most of his life until this heart attack. He'd never had a record of heart disease or heart problems before. But, you know, that's part of what happens with the aging process. And, you know, Joe Biden probably had the best answer on it and said, I'm running because of my age and experience. And with that brings wisdom.
What, who was it that said, I mean, I'm trying to remember the candidate in the past who said, I won't hold your youth against you or something.
Right.
But, you know, I could see, yeah, I could see somebody people.
Your youth and inexperience.
Inexperience
right.
against you. I could see somebody watching last night and watching Bernie Sanders and thinking, wow, I didn't know you could be that vibrant after a heart attack. Because
he has gotten a lot of rest. He's been off the campaign trail and he campaigned so vigorously that maybe the rest for a couple of weeks actually did him some good.
Yeah. Domenico, just in the few seconds, half a minute, what else jumped out at you that you'd want to comment on?
You know, we just have to watch in the next few weeks if there's going to be a boost for any of these candidates. Does anything get reshaped or are we still seeing this sort of aircraft carrier of a race continue? Who knows? A lot of things could be shaken up.
Yeah. Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent on last night's Democratic presidential debate. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Fort Worth interim police chief says there was no excuse for the white police officer who shot and killed a black woman over the weekend. A murder arrest warrant for that officer, Aaron Dean, alleges the woman, 28-year-old Atatiana Jefferson, was holding a gun. Her nephew told authorities that she'd picked it up after hearing noises outside of her window. For more, we're joined by Christopher Connolly from member station KERA. He's in Fort Worth. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Tanya. Happy to be here.
We should note that it is legal to hold a gun in your own home, and the Fort Worth police chief said yesterday that it makes sense that Jefferson would have the gun if she felt threatened. What else do we know?
Yeah, he said it makes sense that she would have the gun if she felt like she was being threatened because somebody was in her backyard. And Miss Jefferson, at the time she was shot, didn't know that the people in her backyard were police because they never identified themselves as such. The nephew, according to that affidavit, said Jefferson pointed the gun toward the window. Dean's partner on the call said she never saw the gun, according to the affidavit. She said that Dean was between her and the window. So it may have been that Dean's body was blocking her view of the gun, but she said she only saw Jefferson's face in the window. And Ed Krause, the interim chief, he said that in hindsight, releasing photos of the gun to the media shortly after the shooting was a bad thing to do because he said that it basically didn't just the presence of the gun didn't justify the shooting. He said nothing justified shooting into a dwelling or a home like that, you know, gun or no gun, especially when the officer didn't know if there was anybody with her, which we know the 8-year-old nephew was in there with her when she was shot. And the last thing on that gun, the lawyer for the Jefferson's family says that Miss Jefferson had legally purchased the weapon and she had a license to carry it.
Right. It was a legal purchase. Absolutely. And she had a license. Now, we know the officer, Aaron Dean, has resigned and was charged with murder for Jefferson's death. Here's Atatiana Jefferson's brother, Adarius Carr, along with the family's lawyer, S. Lee Merritt, talking about the arrest.
We talking about them not liking to arrest cops. So they did that. So
they put them in handcuffs. Yeah.
That's a huge step for us to understand that they are willing to understand that this is serious and we need it. Yeah. Justice is important to us.
What else can you tell us about Dean?
Well, we know that he was a pretty junior officer. He'd been a cop for about 18 months and did the police academy before that. He would have gotten training on de-escalation there and a use of force policy that did not call for shooting into a building the way that he did. We also know that Dean has not made a statement to the police investigators yet. He resigned from the force before he was compelled to give a statement. And now that he's not a police officer, he can't be compelled to give them a statement. So police haven't heard his explanation for what happened that night.
Mm. Let's rewind briefly to earlier this year. The city considered recommendations from a race and culture task force. And one of those recommendations was that the city institute a citizens review board for the police department. This is something that most major police departments already have. Is that coming up again now?
It is. And I think city officials would tell you that it's not that they didn't do a citizens review board, that they're sort of in the process of doing it, but they have a sort of complex process before they get there. So right now they're actually getting ready to start interviewing candidates for a police monitor position. That's a civilian position that'll be a sort of oversight who will run an oversight office. And then that office of the police monitor, when it's up and running, will make recommendations for what the review board should look like. Now, activists will tell you that, you know, they feel like this is being sort of slow walked into happening. They'll tell you that that police monitor's office seems understaffed from the beginning. Austin has about three times as many staffers in their office of the police monitor than the one that Fort Worth is setting up. And then there's a feeling with the review board that sort of the devil is in the details. You know, how much authority will the review board have to independently investigate allegations of police misconduct is a big question.
Mm-hmm. Hundreds of people turned out yesterday for the first Fort Worth City Council meeting. Here's one woman, Jen Sardoi, talking about Ata Tiana's 8-year-old nephew, Zion, who was, as you said, in the room when she was killed.
He needs his aunt alive. He needs to not have witnessed her murder. He needs the city he lives in to be equitable and just and safe from poorly trained, scared, racist police officers.
What else are people saying?
You know, there was a lot of that sentiment in the room that people are afraid of the police. And it was a packed room. I mean, there were hundreds of people there, like you said, you know, too many to fit into the council chambers. There were a bunch of people in the overflow room. And that's really not typical of a city council meeting. And people talked on pretty much every topic and just were really seeming to try to force a conversation on policing in the city of Fort Worth. It was chaotic at times. People were shouting that they really don't feel safe and that they're fed up. And there were calls for the city manager to be fired and for the assistant city manager who oversees the police department.
That's KERA reporter Chris Connolly from Fort Worth, Texas. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Sure thing.
And let's talk more about fear and racial stereotypes and the use of lethal force. Joining us now is Rajiv Sethi, a professor of economics at Barnard College and co-author of Shadows of Doubt, Stereotypes, Crime, and the Pursuit of Justice. He's been looking at how regional distinctions can help us better understand what is fueling excessive use of force by police. Professor Sethi, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Tanya.
Well, since June, in talking about these regional distinctions, Fort Worth police officers have fatally shot 6 people. Based on your work, what do these numbers reveal to you?
There are really huge regional disparities in the use of deadly force in the United States. Fort Worth is actually not quite at the top of the list of LEAs in terms of the use of deadly force, but it's up there. You know, we have tried in our research to understand these regional differences and found that, you know, we cannot explain them based on the usual suspects. So it's not differences in rates of violent crime or the threats faced by police officers or, you know, the prevalence of firearms. There's really something about local law enforcement agency leadership, culture, selection, training that's going on that are giving these very large differences. We tend to think of bad orchards rather than bad apples.
Yes, you use this idea of bad apples versus bad orchards. Can you explain more deeply what you mean? Because in many cases we do hear it may have been just one rogue police officer who committed some sort of atrocity, but you're saying it's much deeper than that.
Yeah, that's right. So the only justification for the use of lethal force by police officers is actually warranted fear or legitimate fear. That the real question then becomes, why is there so much variation across law enforcement agencies in the degree to which people, you know, get fearful, the threshold, levels of fear at which a trigger is pulled?
What are some commonalities that you see? You know, you talk about the West, you talk about the South, and oftentimes when we think about this, we think of it in terms of populations. Maybe perhaps there's a higher incidence of populations of color or socioeconomic differences. You're saying that you don't see those commonalities either when it comes to the use of force.
Yes, actually, the picture is more complicated than commonly perceived, because the states with the highest incidence of lethal force are states like Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, California, which have below national average African-American populations. The same with Oklahoma, West Virginia, for instance. So those are states in which there's a lot of killing, but the racial disparities in victimization are not as great as in the Northeast. And then in the Northeast, you have states with relatively low rates of killing, but where the racial disparities are extreme. Chicago is really the most extreme. It's about an 18-to-1 ratio of black versus white victimization in the case of police homicides. So the areas where you have the largest killings are not necessarily the ones with the greatest racial disparities.
You also write that there is this really this vicious cycle. So in Texas, for instance, many of these black communities have a deep fear and mistrust for police now more than ever. I mean, not just the latest case, but then there's the Dallas police officer case with Amber Geiger convicted of killing Botham Jean. This has a direct impact on how communities relate to officers. And then that has a direct impact on the likelihood of police using force. How do we get past this, or how do we get to a place where we can work through this?
Well, one of the interesting comments that was made in the Fort Worth case by the interim police chief was that this particular incident is like an anthill that's been washed away by a hose. Building police community relations is a painstaking and slow process, especially when there's, you know, historical distrust. But part of it involves stepping back on generalized enforcement practices, like the use of stop and frisk policies at very low levels of suspicion, which trap a lot of innocent folks and, you know, cause them to despise or distrust police and make them unwilling to come forward, for instance, as witnesses or to cooperate in investigations. The other thing that's really important to curtail is the use of civilians as ATM machines or piggy banks. And this was found by a Department of Justice report in the case of Ferguson, when there was an investigation following the killing of Michael Brown, which was that a lot of people are stopped and fined for trivial violations or non-violations as a source of revenue instead of taxes.
For municipalities, yeah.
Municipalities, exactly. And these kind of things actually erode police-community relations, and it's very difficult to build up.
That's Rajiv Sethi, the co-author of Shadows of Doubt, Stereotypes, Crime, and the Pursuit of Justice. Rajiv, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
And now a stat you may already know, in fact, it may be about you. According to the American Public Transportation Association, Americans are taking more rides on trains and buses, 11 million more rides in the second quarter of 2019 compared to last year. Why? Concern for the environment? Traffic? Here Now's transportation analyst Seth Kaplan has taken a look. So Seth, what's the answer? Why?
Yeah, probably a combination of those things. You know, rideshare services, Uber and Lyft have become prevalent in recent years, and to some degree, although it's debatable exactly to what degree, have probably taken some rides away from public transit. So it could just be that they've sort of picked the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, and now it's all stabilizing. But yeah, the important thing here, Robin, is that increase is actually the first increase for a quarter compared to the same period a year earlier since way back in early 2016. Ridership still down from where it was several years back, but finally an uptick after several years of declines.
Well, some cities saw really dramatic jumps. Commuter rail numbers up nearly 85% in Orlando, Florida, 30% in Denver. What's going on?
In those cases, you had either an extension of a line or a new line. Hard to get increases like those just organically. So those are real numbers, but they do have a little bit of an asterisk there. If anything, the even more encouraging trend are numbers like, the New York City subway up 2.5%. That might not sound like a lot, but a year earlier, their figures were down 3.5%. Or even Atlanta, Robin, up 0.1%. Sounds like a waste waste of time to even talk about that, right? But mm-hmm. that system had been down fully 7% a year earlier. So encouraging in terms of the trend. We'll have to see here in coming quarters if that was just a blip or, yeah, finally a bottoming out of what had been a bad trend for several years.
Well, it's interesting you say there's been some expansion because, as we've discussed before, there's also been a national push by the group Americans for Prosperity, funded by Charles Koch and his late brother David, to fight government investment in public transportation, which seems so short-sighted because we need public transportation to get people out of, you know, cars. But you're saying people are making investments.
Yeah, some cities are doing it. There have been a number of initiatives across the country, some more successful than others. But to some degree, there's no question that when you build it, they come. And when you lay new miles of track or when you add new buses, ridership increases. Folks like the Koch family would say, well, that's a whole lot of money for not too many people. But look, we talked about Uber and Lyft. I mean, they're subsidized too, billions of dollars in subsidies, right, essentially by their investors who have been tolerating losses. So we'll see as there's investor pressure on those companies to stop just growing and start becoming profitable if they end up having to raise fares, which would probably be good also for mass transit systems.
Okay, we just have to ask you in the minute we have. A cross-country team from Ocean City, New Jersey was going to a big meet in Orlando when Frontier Airlines canceled their flight out of Philly. And the kids got on and started tweeting. Delta saw the tweets and sent a private plane to pick them up and take them there. Look, if this was a publicity stunt, it worked. We're talking about it. But in the few seconds we have, is this common? Does this happen?
You know, Delta did something similar a few months ago. There was a group of kids going from Oklahoma City to Richmond. In that case, it was an American flight that canceled. Delta came to the rescue. I asked them today if they have somebody like watching for this, and they said, no, that's just us doing
that's
the right thing.
That's just who we are.
And that's just who we are. Probably some combination of altruism good and good
people.
PR, Robin.
Seth Kaplan here, now's transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
There was an article this month in the nonprofit news site The Trace, in collaboration with GQ, that caught our attention. It was about that horrific mass shooting at the 2017 Route 91 Music Festival in Las Vegas and the impact it has had on coroners. In Clark County, the coroner there had to work around the clock to identify and declare the cause of death for the 58 people who were killed that day back in 2017, including the shooter. As you can imagine, it has taken a significant mental and physical toll in what is considered one of the deadliest mass shootings in modern American history. John Futenberg is head coroner for Clark County, and he's been a driving force behind a new effort to make sure that coroners receive the help they need after tragedies like this. And John, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya. I appreciate it.
When we hear about coroners, it's often in direct relation to a tragedy, an investigation, perhaps onto how someone died or under violent or suspicious circumstances. This is really the work that you do. You all are often called experts in death. But what happened here? How does an office like yours even begin to take on such a number?
Well, it's overwhelming to say the least. I mean, we've been very fortunate here in Clark County. We've always had it as an office priority to do a lot of training and exercising, and we've got some support over the years, some federal grant money and different support from different areas in preparing. So I don't want to tell you that we were prepared, because I don't think any coroner medical examiner's office can be prepared for something like this, but we at least had a foundation of training and had an idea of what we would do. So that helped a lot.
One of the things that you all had to do was notify families of the deceased. There was actually 4,000 people who passed through this family assistance center that you and your staff set up for relatives and survivors after the shooting. In this case, it's a major undertaking. You all spent hours and hours there. How did your office do that?
Well, we have had in our local plans to have our agency be the primary agency that handles the Family Assistance Center for probably over a decade. And the one thing that we realized very quickly is that's not a good idea, because we're so overwhelmed by just the recovery of the decedents and performing the postmortem examination on the decedents, and then again notifying their next of kin once we have them identified, that it just wasn't a good idea. So we were very fortunate where our Clark County Office of Emergency Management, which is under our Clark County Fire Department, came in and really helped us through it and provided a huge amount of support. So we couldn't have done it without their help. Fortunately, that went pretty well, all things considered.
I'm just thinking about this. This is the job that you do, but you're also human beings. Before this shooting, you developed a survey for your staff in order to understand the psychological impacts of this work. What did you learn from that survey?
Well, the idea was we have, and it I want to make it clear, it wasn't me. It was you know, I contributed to it, but there were a lot of people that were involved in just trying to figure out what we could do for our staff. You know, the survey was really designed to talk about, this was pre-October 1, so this was something that, you know, it's not a secret that, right, it was. It was before the shooting, and it was something that, you know, it's no secret that our staff, they see things that police and fire aren't even exposed to on a regular basis, and you can imagine what police and fire see. So our staff are responding to two or three tragic, unexpected deaths every single shift. So to think that we shouldn't have some sort of wellness efforts already in place. And so the survey was designed just to ask the staff what types of calls that they find difficult and what types of services would match those types of calls. So we found what we thought we would find, and that was that they didn't want it to be mandatory, and we found what a lot of agencies have found, that the peer-to-peer support is really the most beneficial type of support. You know, they don't want to sit down with a manager after they handle this call, because that's intimidating and that can add a level of stress in and of itself. So that's what the survey was designed to find out.
You also, after the shooting, realized that people needed help badly. You brought in counselors, a bunch of other unorthodox comforting measures, 19 golden retrievers, meditation and yoga instructors, soft lighting and floor cushions. How did your staff react to all of this?
You know, there was a percentage of staff that responded very well to that and really took advantage of it. But one of the challenges is these people are so used to what they're dealing with that oftentimes it's hard to even get them to participate in the different types of services. So what we were trying to do is just throw all sorts of services at them, and hopefully they would take advantage of something. So I think it was successful. I mean, we did, you mentioned some of the non-traditional services that were successful, and then some of the traditional, the group debriefings and things like that were successful. But I don't think you can ever do enough for people that see what our staff sees, but we're just trying to help in any way we can.
Let's talk a little bit about cost. There wasn't funding set aside for these therapeutic programs, so you went to the state legislature to change that. Tell us more about that effort.
Well, after the shooting, there was some support from the federal government. There's a federal grant that's made available to communities that have had this sort of incident, and that's what got us through about the first year. But you know, these types of incidences are extremely expensive for local government. So we were fortunate enough to get a bill passed during our 2019 legislative session here in Nevada, and that bill is going to provide at least $100,000, if not $200,000 a year to develop a mental health program. So we're working with the University of Las Vegas, of Nevada, Las Vegas, and they're actually doing a research project, and they're working on a mental health program, mental health and wellness program that we're gonna try to publish, and we're gonna use here in our office and tie that funding directly to their recommendations. So we're very excited about that potential. And as importantly, we're going to try to publish that so the whole country and every corner medical examiner's office can take advantage of that, because it's just not something that our local governments can fund. So it's always a battle to get the funding to help with things like that.
You mentioned, John, how you would love to see this operationalized in Las Vegas and in other places. What other changes would you like to see, not only for Clark County, but for coroners throughout the country?
Well, I think it's plain, it's very simple, and that is make it a priority, right? Everybody wants to hide behind the excuse of not having funding available, and certainly that's a good reason to you know, that's a realistic barrier. But I think people just need to make it a priority. And first is recognition. I mean, there's so many people in our field that think that if you ignore the wellness and the mental health of your staff, you can get through it. And if you pay a lot of attention to it, you almost create victims and bring that attention to it. And I think that's just ridiculous thinking. I think the priority needs to be just making the awareness and being aware that you've got to do something aggressive for the mental health of people who are seeing, you know, these tragic deaths every day of their life, and then turning around and notifying their family members. I mean, you can imagine how stressful it would be to knock on the door of a mother whose 16-year-old daughter got killed in a motor vehicle accident at 2 a.m. and you're the one notifying her of that, right? That's a stressful job, not to mention picking the human remains up off the highway after an accident. And I know that sounds very graphic, but I think that's, you know, that's the reality, and that's something that our staff deal with every day. So we've got to pay attention to it and understand that unless you do something, they're gonna suffer, and they'll probably still suffer, but at least you can minimize that a bit.
John, thank you for shedding light on the work that you do. That's John Futenberg. He is head coroner for Clark County. Thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The UK and the EU are working against the clock to draft an acceptable Brexit deal before the end of this month, which is when Prime Minister Boris Johnson had threatened to take Britain out of the European Union, whether or not there was a deal. Big sticking point, what happens to the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and Ireland, which is part of the EU? Right now, there is no hard border, and the Irish on both sides want to keep it that way. NPR London correspondent Frank Langford is here. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Robin.
So this is a very fluid situation.
It is.
Yeah, but start with the Northern Ireland question. As we said, right now, no hard border between the two countries. Right now, Northern Ireland, of course, would have to leave the EU if Britain does. It's part of the UK. Presumably would have to have a border there, stopping the free flow between the two countries. So what are some of the solutions being offered to that problem?
Well, what it looks like now, and we haven't seen, we're looking forward to seeing the draft to see exactly what it says. But the whole point, as you point out, is to avoid a hard border there. And one solution is to actually what they call create a border down the Irish Sea. So I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. If you were going to export sugar from Great Britain across the water into Northern Ireland, an importer would have to pay an import tax on that, and then it could go on to Ireland as a part of the EU. Now, if, in fact, the sugar stays there in Northern Ireland, the importer gets a rebate. And this is a way to sort of avoid having customs posts, which would be so disruptive to the island of Ireland.
And so what's been the reaction to that? Because there are people in Northern Ireland. I mentioned the Irish on both sides of the border want to keep it a free and open border. But is everybody in agreement?
No. The Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland has not liked this idea for a long time, because they're very concerned that anything that separates Northern Ireland from Great Britain, they feel, affects their identity and the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. But the big thing that they're now asking for is they want to have some kind of veto over this, so that if in a few years they really, really don't like it, they can get out of it. Well, the EU doesn't want to give them a veto on this right now. And that's what they're negotiating over. And they seem to have the most leverage domestically. People are waiting to see if they will sign on to this. And then other Brexiteers have said that if it's okay with the Democratic Unionist Party, they'll join in and support a deal.
Yeah, well, sure, this whole conversation is picking at the very old wound of the division of Northern Ireland and Ireland. So, you know, there's that. And just to check our thinking here, Frank Langford, it feels as if Prime Minister Theresa May, maybe even in trying to appease the hardline Brexiteers, said she would never accept the kind of border that's now being proposed between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And now we have Boris Johnson, the hardest of the hardliner, maybe accepting it?
Maybe. Well, what a difference a year or so makes, and we're up against a hard deadline. And I think that there's a bit of a reality check here in the United Kingdom. The idea that the British government thought that it could drive these negotiations and bring the EU to its knees has not happened. It doesn't have the leverage. The EU is much, much larger economically, and the United Kingdom will still need a free trade agreement when this is all over with. So I think what you're seeing is kind of a reluctant realization that the UK has to compromise a lot if it wants to get through this and avoid a no-deal Brexit, which would be very bad economically for the country here, and it would also hurt the European Union.
I mentioned in the introduction that Prime Minister Boris Johnson had threatened to just walk away even if there was no deal at the end of the month. What's going on there?
I think he's, you know, he said he'd rather be dead in a ditch than ask for another extension. Well, Mr. Johnson has, through his members of his own cabinet have said that he actually will sign a letter to extend if by Saturday he can't get some kind of deal. And I think what we've seen, you know, Boris Johnson is a very flexible politician and he's a bit of a realist. And he knows that while he's taken a very hard line to try to win over lots of tough Brexiteer members of his party, the fact of the matter is he doesn't have much choice there because Parliament has already passed a law saying he must do this. Mm. So he'd be breaking the law if he didn't.
Well, it sounds like he's not going to go that far.
No, it doesn't sound like it.
Right. So what happens next?
Well, I think we have to watch the rest of this day to see if we actually do get some kind of an agreement. And then there's an EU summit that begins on Thursday where they would hope to ratify that agreement, but they may not have an agreement to ratify. Then it would go to the Parliament on Saturday, and there could be an attempt there to actually, even if there is a deal, to attach an amendment saying we want to take this deal back to the people to see if they will ratify it or if they don't want to leave the EU. So not out of the woods, even if they get some kind of tentative deal with the EU, not out of the woods yet because the politics of this country are very polarized and not certain at all.
Mm. Well, you're there in London. What are the people saying? What is the talk?
I think there are a lot of people who want this thing over with. It's been nearly 3.5 years. I have met people who voted to remain, who are in the business community, who say they can't make any decisions and they would like to get out. We see different kinds of polls. We see some polls that show a 6-point swing that if you held this referendum again, in part because many of the older people who voted to leave have passed away and younger people now could vote who would want to stay. In fact, the referendum would go the other way. But it has been so divisive that many people would just not want to put the country through that and just find a way to move on and begin to heal what has been a bitter, bitter divide here.
Yeah. NPR London correspondent Frank Langford, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Robin.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley at NPR West in Culver City, California. It's Here and Now.